Well, Bill, Alex Harvey, he was fun. He's a guy I met down when I came saw you. We did that little road trip and got to spend a little time together. He's just one of the good ones, and you know, teaches me about the Southern traditions as you do. So
it's so cool because we basically almost have the same background. I mean, he grew up in Mississippi on farms, hunting and fishing. I grew up in Tennessee on a farm, hunting and fishing, and ended up in the conservation arena. So hearing about his background and then about his work to try to help other folks in the South, you know, whether it's to get back into hunting or get involved in hunting or to help rural landowners take advantage of, you know, or take advantage is the wrong word, but avail themselves of the help that they can get that they just didn't know about.
Yeah. And I mentioned it in the podcast, legacy, the word legacy, man. Every time I talk to him, it's kind of like he has these like familial stories. And then, you know, his work is to like improve habitat and get more people engaged and do all this stuff. And it really does bring home that word. And he named his business that, and it's kind of like,
right,
that's what it's all about. You know, tell your stories, bring other people into the fold, help with conservation, help with habitat. I just really like talking to him because he just does all that so well. He's just a great emissary for it.
He is, and we need more Alexes in the world.
We do.
Obviously, we need new hunters. We need new blood. We need new people coming in for nothing else, the conservation dollars they provide. But obviously, there's so much more, and people like Alex are the tip of the spear making that happen.
And I can't get enough of all the little, you know, hunting culture is kind of the same in one way. Like you get to talking to people and there's so many shared narratives, but then there's all these little folds and twists and plots and turns and nooks and crannies. I just love that. And kind of no matter who I talk to, people who just hunt and fish and are passionate about it, there's always just these little nuances and great things that are fun to talk about that just really kind of pull at you. And you're like, oh, I want to know more about that.
Well, you know, we mentioned Holt Collier in the podcast, and I don't know if you've ever read Holt Collier. If you hadn't, I'll get you the book. But Holt was the guide when the whole teddy bear episode went down. Mm. He had captured this bear and was basically staked it out to make it an easy kill, and Roosevelt refused to do it. They ended up hunting together many times over the years. He even tried to get Holt to go with him to Africa on safaris. So, that history is kind of cool in Mississippi with African Americans.
Yeah. I mean, I know the cursory, like the, you know, the very short Cliff Notes version, but you're right. I should read the longer version.
Yeah.
This would be a good spur to do it. Anyway, folks, go check out this episode. Alex Harvey was our guest. You're going to like this one.
Since 1936, the National Wildlife Federation has worked with hunters and anglers to pass the most important conservation laws of American history and to protect our sporting traditions. This podcast explores our history, our values, and the work we do to safeguard the fish and wildlife that fuel our passions. We are NWF Outdoors.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to the NWF Outdoors podcast here with my buddy and co-host, Bill Cooksey. What's happening, Big Bill?
Aaron, what's up, man? All good in Tennessee.
Good. And today we are lucky to have yet another good guest, a new friend of mine. We got to meet each other in December after I had learned a little bit about him, but we got to spend some time together. What's happening today, Alex?
How you doing, man? How's it going? How are both of you? Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And today we have Alex Harvey, and he is down in Mississippi, and we wanted to have Alex on for a couple different reasons. We were just talking about this kind of pre-show. He really has connected this intersection between his background and his personal life and his professional life. And he's just doing everything as far as like taking care of habitat, advocating for hunters, all kinds of good stuff. And we just really wanted to talk to him. And once I met him in person, I was like, man, we got to have this guy on the podcast. Yeah. So here we are finally doing it. Yeah. And thank you, Alex. Yeah, I'm going to tell folks about you a little, and then we'll jump in. So, Alex is the consulting forester and wildlife biologist, and he's president of his company called Legacy Land Management LLC. And it's one of the very few African-American owned natural resource management firms in the entire country. And he has a long education that led him there. He has a Bachelor of Science in Forestry and Wildlife Management from Mississippi State University's College of Forest Resources. He also has leadership development work in the Society of American Foresters National Leadership Academy and multiple other different kind of leadership and forestry background type of things. And then I should also tell you, he's been doing this for quite a while, and he works with all kinds of folks in the state and federal government, universities, nonprofits, and works really with this diverse background in forest management, wildlife management, natural resource management, policy, all kinds of different things. And it brought him here to this moment. And so we're happy about that. And we'll get in a little bit more to his background, because it's so distinguished and long, it's hard to do it justice there in the beginning. But first, we'll start with what we've been doing outside, because we like to do that. So we'll let you start this time, Alex, and then we'll jump over to Bill and I.
Oh man, so I was recently rabbit hunting, a little bit of quail hunting over in Central and South Georgia, and
oh yeah, we saw some good pictures too. Yeah thanks man, for this.
Yes, of course. Rabbit hunting has such a long history in my family. And so, we can go on and on about how much I enjoyed this recent experience I had, and how much it sort of connected me back to stories that I remember growing up from my mom's family, my dad's family, and everyone in between in my community. So, but rabbit hunting and quail hunting has kind of been, it's the last thing I did outside.
That sounds awesome. How about you, Big Bill? We will get into that too, Alex, because I think, again, so many things intertwined there.
I'm going to ask if he started a kennel for his pack of beagles that he's going to go ahead and pick up.
I have not yet.
I actually spent the weekend on the shores of beautiful Kentucky Lake replacing the axle on a boat trailer. So I was outside, part of it in a sleet storm. And I don't know if you've ever replaced the axle on a trailer, a boat trailer that's had it on it for 25 years. It's not fun.
No,
it's not fun at all.
There's humidity with some rust and all the good stuff. Yeah.
The good part of it was the lake is so high and muddy that it wasn't even tempting to go fish. So I got my work.
There you go.
What about you, man? What have you been doing?
Well, I spent the weekend doing something kind of odd, outside. I've been dealing with the neck issue that's like pinching a nerve in my neck, and it's been getting better. And every year I go on a trip for 20 plus years now, the group of old buddies in the middle of winter, we do a backpacking trip, and, it's this coming weekend. Right. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to cut it, and I'm trying to figure out. So I put a 40 pound sack of brand new dog food and a few other things in a backpack and went trudging up a drainage. Did about 3 or 4 miles off trail just to see how it would go, because I've been pretty nervous. Did okay. Slept okay that night. Not so much last night, but I'm moving towards it. I think I'm just going to deal with whatever pain comes, because it's just really not worth missing. But not the typical outdoor adventure, but still was a good time and always good to learn from the outdoors. They'll teach you stuff. So anyway, let's dive in a little bit, Alex. I think one of the things we really wanted to unpack, as we said, is, your personal background, your sporting history, and how that kind of led you to where you are. I've heard you talk on a couple different other podcasts. I've heard you a couple different mediums. You've got this fascinating story. And I think one of the myths that I love to hear you dispel, right, is like that, that the hunting and fishing and so on hasn't been traditionally something that Black folks partake in.
Right.
We know that not to be true, but I think that's a narrative that's out there sometimes. And you're one of the best I've ever heard talk about that. And I'll just preface this first question with that, in that, just throw us your personal background, where you grew up, your connection to the outdoors, those kinds of things.
Okay. So, I'm from a mixture of central Mississippi as well as north central Mississippi. My parents moved to the Mississippi Hill Country back in the late 60s as student teachers, and they kind of never left. But my mom and dad were from down around Jackson, Mississippi, Hinds County. So between there and, you know, the Delta and the hills of Holmes County is kind of where I grew up. And my parents had a cattle farm, and we cattle farmed and row cropped and all of that growing up. And then my dad was also a part of a hunting club up there in the hill country in the Delta. So I kind of grew up between all of those experiences and all of those places with a whole bunch of Mississippi culture mixed in, you know? Yeah.
I love it, 'cause that really sounds a lot like my upbringing. I mean, you know, growing up in the country, everybody hunted and fished. I mean, if you and I look a little different.
Yeah.
But like when I'd go rabbit hunting, and that's traditionally been a very, it was very much in the Black culture in my region. I mean, tons of rabbit hunters.
Yes.
So if I was rabbit hunting, I was the one that looked a little different a lot of times because, you know, I'm going with a bunch of Black dudes.
That's
I was a little white guy.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird how that's changed over the years. It seems to be maybe moving in the right direction again, but, but I'm interested to hear you expound on that.
Yeah, so
as we move on,
you know, I grew up. So my mom's father was a pastor, and a bird hunter, and also was really big into rabbit hunting. And then my dad's folks were largely rabbit hunters and small game, you know, and. And then when I came along, like I said, my dad joined a hunting club up in the Mississippi Hill Country where deer were very prevalent up there. And so, you know, I kind of really got into deer hunting until much later. And, you know, but I always grew up with these stories of rabbit hunting being and quail hunting being so beloved and so common within the community, you know, that I grew up. And, you know, I was just recently relaying a story. So my grandmother, whom I lost in 2002, my dad's mom, I can remember I was very young, but she would always tell this story about when she first got married to my granddad. And one day she was with my great-grandmother, who was my grandfather's mom. And my grandfather's mom noticed there was a rabbit on the farm. And so she took a pistol and shoved it into my grandmother's hand and said, you know, go shoot that rabbit. Right. And so my grandmother ended up, you know, having to pursue this rabbit for a while. But she did shoot it. And she always told that story so joyously. And even, you know, just this past weekend or so, I was, you know, sitting down with a couple of uncles on both sides of the family who are very accomplished rabbit hunters in their own right. And, you know, they were sharing stories of having rabbit hunted with my dad. Now, I lost my dad when I was a student at Mississippi State. And so, you know, we actually never rabbit hunted together, my dad and I, but he loved it. He loved it. And, you know, and so what's interesting about that is because I've always spent the majority of my life really, you know, pursuing deer and other things. You know, to kind of come back to rabbit hunting now, and, you know, and immediately for me, I've shot a few rabbits here and there, but just never really sort of got into the whole thing of it all. And a recent experience that I had, it sort of really changed something for me in the most profound way, simply because I recognized something that has sort of kind of always been there. You know, I hunted with six guys that I'd never met before. They were all much older than me. And, you know, within that experience
where, I mean, they were very kind. They were very nice when I got there, but it was just sort of, you know, handshaking and, you know, let's let the dogs out and let's walk into the woods. And after we had hunted for a while and I got a rabbit and sort of, you know, everybody sort of kind of to kind of mold together and have conversations. And I really recognized the sort of cadence and rhythm of all those experiences that I'd had growing up where, you know, the banter, the conversations, the chatter, the laughter, you know, the love that everyone had for each other, you know, given this experience and even the reverence of the experience, you know, of nature sort of pressing down on you as you're pursuing these rabbits. Right. And sort of how that humanizes everybody. And so, I can't say enough about what this experience has sort of done for me in the way that, you know, I really wish that I would have had that experience with my dad. But I also am all, you know, I feel very connected and really even very excited, simply because, you know, I recognize the tone and the rituals of a culture that I remember growing up as a kid that has, by and large, unfortunately vanished in many ways. And so, it was a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed it. So,
but you're here to keep it alive. That's the
good news. I am definitely here to keep it alive. I will say, yes, this is subject matter that is definitely very, very important to me. And for so many reasons, and you know, everything I do, as you pointed out, is sort of interconnected. I'm a country kid. I grew up on a farm. You know, I sort of grew up in these pretty rural communities where, by and large, yes, everybody was African American. Everybody was outdoorsy. Everybody was, you know, really connected to nature in a way that I think is oftentimes, you know, and as well as historically sort of been overlooked. Right. And so, you know, I am always, I guess, you know, very eager to talk about those experiences that I had growing up as a kid and how these experiences in many ways are what it means, I guess, for me is, you know, profoundly African-American experiences, you know, because if you are African American, then the likelihood is that your parents or grandparents or someone came from the American South, right? And there is a lot to be said about, you know, how that history, you know, has for a number of reasons vanished, and how there's now this sort of renaissance taking place of people getting back to it. Right. And that's the beauty of it all. You know,
let's peel back the layers of that onion a little bit more. Cause I know when we've talked before, Alex, you know, you've talked about kind of multi-generational, you have stories about your grandparents, and maybe they even had stories about their parents, you know, tell that story, like bring us from, you know, what your grandparents were experiencing to what brought you. And then, you know, I don't know if there's a good way to answer this one but it's a unique question that I have kind of based on what you just said. You know, I feel like when I talk to you, there's this, I don't even know the right word, but you know, this way that like everything you do kind of circles itself and reinforces that, like, you're on the right path with what you're doing, you know, and you keep getting these constant reminders from like your background and your history and where your path's leading now. And, you know, maybe there's something in that you can talk about too.
Yeah. So I think, man, that's a wonderful question. So I do think there's a sort of chronology, you know, in terms of generational experiences and how they are connected, right? In terms of like things that I learned from my dad. And, you know, I have an older brother who's 10 years older than me, can relay more experiences about my grandfather, whom I never met, or all of those things. But I've always, absolutely always had a sense of connectedness to you know, previous generations in terms of like stories that my dad, you know, told me, or even just feeling a sense of presence when you're walking around the family farm, you know, something as simple as that, right? But I think that, you know, my dad would oftentimes talk about, you know, what it meant growing up and how they really depended on, you know, wild game as a means of subsistence. Right. And so and he was a very passionate hunter, you know, and I was also, again, I was very fortunate to go to his, you know, his hunting club and get to know all the men that were also a part of that. And many of them became much like fathers as well. And all of those experiences, man, I think the best way to explain it is a sort of mysticism in a way with how they feel, you know, how they are connected to nature, and they sort of pass along that narrative. Of course, a lot of the history of the African-American experience in terms of land and our relationship with land is not very good, you know, but for what it's worth, even beyond all of that, is in communities that I go to today and that I work in today, and in, you know, the communities that I remember growing up as a kid, there was always a sense of love and admiration and pride in the relationship that everyone had with the land. And, you know, even if we were just, you know, we were just sort of recreating, sitting around and you know, laughing and having jokes, or if we were working on the farm or what have you. And, you know, I think all of those experiences, for what it's worth, you know, they reflect, you know, not only, you know, just the basic elements of the human experience, but they also reflect a deeper complexity in terms of what it means to be African-American within this narrative of the American South, or within this narrative of what it means to be American and connected to nature and all of that. And so, yeah, I feel like I can ramble on about these things for hours simply because of what my passion for these things. But I, you know, I would say, you know, given, you know, this wonderful opportunity that I get every day to live and sort of make an impact in terms of conservation, working in these communities, talking about forest management issues or wildlife management issues, or helping these families understand that their land is an asset and how to leverage and access that asset in terms of creating better wildlife habitat and relationships with, you know, folks who are looking for hunting leases, or if it's working within municipalities, within, you know, with elected officials and so forth, talking about these things in terms of their value, these green spaces to, you know, small towns and larger cities and all of that, you know, these things are, in many ways, they're sort of endless, but they are all our story. You know, you sort of can't crank up your car and go from home to your office or from one place to another without having a sense of connectedness to green spaces, even if you're just looking out of the window and you're enjoying that. Or if you are somebody who are from an area and you have stories to tell about people you've known and things you remember growing up or what have you, you know, we all, for what it's worth, have this sense of, you know, identity with nature. Right.
You know, it's just occurred to me, Theodore Roosevelt, who, you know, most mm-hmm. of us as sportsmen, he's kind of a mm-hmm. icon. He had said once the greatest hunter he ever met was an African-American mm-hmm. bear hunter from the Mississippi Delta.
His name was Holt Collier. Yes, indeed.
That's right.
And, you know, that's somebody that, you know, I have a good friend of mine who insists that, you know, that Holt Collier's in his family, you know, line. But I, you know, I would say, and you know, this is something that, again, I get really passionate about, Bill, because, I watch hunting shows, you know, from time to time, and you know, I see the fact that a lot of people, you know, have done really well financially with just, you know, creating content, But I can absolutely tell you that, you know, some of the men that raised me, that were a part of my dad's hunting club, are some of the very best outdoorsmen, you know, that I've seen. I'm a forester. I'm a wildlife biologist. I've been all over the country. I've met a lot of people. I've met a lot of very well-educated people and all of that. But I can honestly say to you that, the sense of ethics, the sense of value, the sense of connectedness, the reverence for the pursuit of game, the reason why we hunt, all of those things, are very much intact in many ways in the African-American community of the rural South. And, you know, I feel really strongly about that. And, the notion that Hope Kai was perhaps one of the best, to ever do it comparable to Daniel Boone, I've heard a lot of people say, which I'm sure was probably the case. But I would also say that there are average, ordinary guys right now who are walking around who are some of the very best outdoorsmen that the world has never heard of. You know, that's something that I think we need to work on, because, you know, the future of hunting is profoundly important to all of us. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times, you know, the narrative becomes, you know, hunting is this really horrible thing that it isn't. And I think the more we engage, you know, diverse communities within this conversation of their experiences and their stories and allowing them to put their stories and experiences out there, then we find a broader coalition of people who are in fact very, you know, very passionate about it and are advocates. And that's certainly what we need, you know.
Let's get to that a little later, because I know, like, your work with HOC and some of the other folks there I want to talk about too, but maybe let's talk a little bit more distinctly about your professional work, because you have this mm-hmm. this great business out there improving habitat. Mm-hmm. You know, just give us a day in the life. Okay. What are you working on? What kind of projects you got going? What are your goals right now?
Man, I've got so many things going on right now, from timber sales to prescribed burning to, you know, habitat management plans and some environmental work on specific things with utility companies and the like. So there's a lot happening. You know, I think for me, in order to talk about the work that I do now, it's always important for me to kind of take a step back and talk about the way that I got here. And, you know, I worked for, of course, out of college, I worked for the U.S. Forest Service for about 6 or 7 years on the Allegheny National Forest up in northwest of Pennsylvania. And I really just got tired of those winters. Okay. And I wanted to get out of there. So, you know, I managed to find my way back south. And I heard about this sort of groundbreaking work that was taking place with some nonprofit organizations that was really new, working with the African-American farmers, families, landowners in three target areas. At the time, it was Alabama, South Carolina, and North Carolina. And that was, at the time, it was called the African-American Sustainable Forestry and Land Retention Program. And it was kind of spearheaded by this philanthropy called the U.S. Endowment for Forestry and Communities. And I heard about this work. And there was a nonprofit in Alabama that was doing it called the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. And so I applied for that position, and I was fortunate enough to get it. And then when I got it, you know, it sort of brought all of this stuff home to me. So all of the book learning, if you will, that I learned at Mississippi State and with the Forest Service about, you know, forestry and wildlife management and all these, you know, really sort of, you know, academic things, you know, to be able to apply them in communities that people look just like me. And I could totally understand their perspectives and their history and all these things. And so I did that work for about 3.5 years, helping to develop and pilot what is now called the Sustainable Forestry and Land Retention Program for African Americans. And after that time, I decided that I thought the most impact that I could make in these communities was to become a private consultant. And so I wanted to step away and start my own company for a number of reasons. One, the issue of timber sales, is it just looms profoundly large in rural communities. And, you know, the selling of timber is just really actually very complicated thing. And most people don't understand how this whole thing works. And when you get to minority communities where there's a common theme of lack of access to information, then these communities get taken advantage of a great deal. And one of the things that the U.S. Endowment did during that time was they brought in a team of researchers to sort of profile these landowners to understand why they did not hire professional consultants and natural resource professionals to help them manage their assets in terms of their land. And so I decided that, you know, based on that, because one of the things that came out of that was they did not see people that looked like them who were in the ranks of consultancy, right? And so I thought, well, if representation matters, then it's time to take a faithful step and actually get out there in a way where, you know, I can do something that I'm passionate about. I can still be an advocate for the folks and communities that I represent and care about. And I can make an impact in terms of conservation and hunting and all of those things. And so that's why I started Legacy Land Management back in 2017. And, you know, from there, via a number of partnerships with the U.S. Endowment for Forestry and Communities, Southern Forestry Consultants and Wiregrass Ecological out of Bainbridge, Georgia, and others, you know, over the last several years, I've sort of been developing the brand of Legacy and what all that means in terms of working within these communities. So I just really worked at sort of developing that brand and beginning the process of sort of, furthering the information and education exchange that needs to take place within these communities for folks to sort of understand that there have for a long time been systems in place to access the wealth that is already in your control in terms of the forest land that you own, right? And so, I'm really excited. I love forestry. I love natural resources management, and I love, you know, thinking about all these things and being able to sort of be one of the few faces that look like mine in a community that is sort of always been out there in terms of consulting foresters and wildlife biologists and so forth. But I will say that one of the greatest things that we face as a nation is the reality that, we're rapidly changing in terms of diversity. And, in terms of, the profession of forestry and wildlife management and all those things, as, all this stuff connects back to hunting. But, you know, if we are to be viable in the future, it's critically important that there are diverse voices in the room who sometimes push back on maybe, the way that we've quote unquote always done things, right? And it's not that the intent of why we've always done things is bad. Sometimes it's just not necessarily very well informed. And so, or it doesn't take into account, somebody else's experiences or all of that. And so, it's very energizing, man, day in and day out, to pursue the opportunity to just, to try to make an impact day in and day out working with folks and representing them and giving them, information where there has not been that sort of information there before.
That's good stuff. And anyone who spends a lot of time in the rural South knows family farms and small farms in general they're dying fast.
Yes,
and
very fast.
Obviously a big challenge.
Yeah.
And you've already identified one issue for African American landowners. I mean, let's face it, when we're looking for someone to trust, we've had our parents, we've had our preachers. Generally, those are people that look kind of like us.
Right.
So I get that. Are there some other unique challenges for the African American landowners in the South?
Yeah, the issue of heirs property, right? And that's where, unfortunately, African Americans have not always been able to trust the legal system in many ways. And so, it was believed for generations that if you passed away and you didn't leave a will, that this sort of you know, encumbered the property so that it would never be lost into families, right? That families would always have control of it. And that's actually the exact opposite. That is the number one cause of land loss, right? Is when someone passes away and they don't leave a will. And it also, you know, it locks people out of the opportunity to pursue this sort of wealth creating mechanism of USDA conservation programs and other opportunities. And so, you know, literally what it does is it, you know, the legal system is sort of like who actually owns it. You know, so you have people who, you know, their grandparents and their great grandparents and every generation that anyone can remember grew up on a piece of property. And, you know, there may be, you know, I've worked with families where there were 60 owners to 30 acres, you know, and that basically renders a piece of property valueless in many ways, because there's no way you're going to get 60 people to agree on one thing. Right. So there are a number of really complicated issues. And you know, for what it's worth, I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of perception also that a lot of these avenues are not necessarily very welcoming in terms of working with African-American communities as well. And I spend a lot of my time, trying to be the bridge there to say, you know, there is a definite system for how this happens, and it looks after your interests. And, you know, here is how you get it done. And, you know, so great question, because there are a number of things that, you know, that are sort of nuanced and very complicated. And, you know, if you are from the American South, I mean, you're probably pretty well acquainted with the nuances of Southern life, right? And what all that means. So yeah.
I'm not well acquainted. I see you guys shaking your heads, and I'm like, I don't know. But when I come down, I sure enjoy it.
Yeah.
Alex, what about, you know, you talked about some of the challenges and so on, but are you seeing it getting better? And I mean, a lot of the work you're doing is the kind of thing that makes it better, right? You're kind of greasing the skids, you're giving people information, you're helping do projects. Yeah. That's one question. I got another one for you right after that, because I think it's going to lead good to some of the sporting stuff too.
Yeah, I definitely think that that change is happening, man. And it's quite a thing to see, you know. Whereas, you know, one of the things that I do is I work with African-American families that sometimes, for the most part, they don't even live in the same state as their land. Right. And so, you know, they're looking for partners, if you will, to help them, you know, turn that land into a better asset. And a lot of times that turns out being leaseholders who are interested in hunting. And so whereas you take these lands that have not at all, for what it's worth, had conservation practices implemented at least in the last 60 years, you know, because our past land use practices in many ways were actually conservation practices, in the past. But, you know, a lot of these lands have not really had conservation implemented. So what we're doing is actually creating healthier habitat for wildlife. And what's funny about that is the bridges that come out of that in terms of people who are from rural African-American communities who have not necessarily felt that those communities even were welcoming or friendly. And so when I connect, for instance, you know, a white guy who is a hunter who just wants to lease a nice place that he's going to take care of, and only he and his, you know, son or daughter or whomever will hunt. And he has that same level of investment in terms of working with this African-American family, because he also wants to maintain his relationship there in that family. I mean, it has a very transformative effect. Not only does it transform the relationship between those partners, but it ultimately transforms those communities, because they start generating revenue in ways that, you know, that they had not probably seen before. And it has an overall positive effect in terms of how people perceive each other, you know, and what we perceive each other's interest to be in terms of how we communicate. Right. So yeah.
I love that, because I'm always telling the story of how hunting and being out on the land is a connective thing. Mm. Right? A lot of people are like, oh, if I can't do it, then, you know, maybe it would separate me away. But it's like one time you come along and all of a sudden you're part of this community and, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of mm-hmm. start building towards it. Howdy, listeners. For more great content, check out NWF Outdoors social media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Connect with us. We want to hear from you. Send us your ideas for podcast guests and questions in the comments.
And for even more excellent content, here's a message from our partner podcast.
Hey everyone, this is Marcia Brownlee from Artemis Sportswomen. We know you love awesome stories about hunting, fishing, and conservation. So head on over to the Artemis podcast. You'll meet adventurous, accomplished women who are redefining conservation through their lives in the field and on the water. Filled with humor, audacity, empathy, and intelligence, Artemis brings you new voices and introduces you to women from all walks of the sporting community. Find Artemis wherever you get your podcasts.
I've got a little bit of forestry in my background. Sometimes I walk in the forest and I think, you know, I got it all figured out. They just need to do a little this over here and all of that over there. I start prescribing in my mind, you know, like, here's what you could do to really take care of this place and hook it up. And I wonder, you know, you probably do that all the time, right? You hit these pieces of land and you're like, oh, if you're trying to do some quail stuff, you got this and some whitetail. I mean, is that how you feel when you get out to land?
I can't turn that thing off, man. I mean, day in and day out, I'm riding down the road with my wife and daughter or whomever, and I'm thinking about, you know, prescribing something another, you know, to a piece of property that I see. So I do it very often. And
Forester's curse. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And so, you know, it's that thing that I think, though, that I don't know. I kind of see, you know, me as sort of, you know, I'm just doing work that's broader than me, man. Things that are far, you know, that'll go and live, you know, way beyond my time here. And so, you know, when I'm doing that, I guess I just see it as kind of practicing. It's constant practice for the next case, the next opportunity, the next family, the next, you know, whatever that is. But yeah, you know, and then, you know, the thing that sort of comes along with that is, you know, if you're a forester, you know, then, you know, you can get, you know, 10 foresters together and, you know, you'll probably have 10 different opinions on how to do something because we don't oftentimes always agree on the same way to do things. But yes, it is, it's something that I do constantly. And, I feel a sense of connect, you know, you know, some of my colleagues, they have to remind me, you know, Alex, you got to pull back. You're too emotionally invested in this, you know, this particular issue or that, you know, this kind of thing, like, you know, cause I do have lots of frustrations when I'm trying to help people and trying to move them forward and things are not necessarily going as I would hope. And, you know, that is, yeah, I don't know. I guess the long and the short of it is I just take this thing seriously, you know?
Yeah. Well, don't let them take that that passion out of you. That's the good stuff. let me ask you one thing, and maybe I'll quit rambling and let Bill talk a little bit more here. But so, you know, all this background, and I guess something else that I recognized when you were talking, because you said it, you said the words legacy, right? And you also talked about mysticism around this and how this all, but really legacy is probably the right word to define it, right? It's like you come from it, you're creating it. It's kind of what the sporting conservation ethos should be about. It's kind of like our history.
Yeah.
And if we're doing a good job, we're carrying that forward, right?
Because that's right.
That's really us. We want this thing to be something that's always there. We want to, like, I can dream of years from now when our grandkids are out there hunting, right? And we're dead and gone. But we need to know that that's true. We need to know that our work made that happen or else then it's all over, right? If we can't imagine that moment in the future. But anyway, I think that kind of helped me pin that after you were talking there. But let's connect that professional work with the sporting conservation advocacy you've been getting mm-hmm. into, because mm-hmm. or you probably have been for a while. It's more just hit my radar, right? Mm-hmm. You work with HOC, Hunters of Color.
Yes.
Some other work you've been doing. Yeah. Just talk about how you know, what was your first kind of dive into that and then how it's progressed?
I kind of connected with Hunters of Color very fortuitously. I was invited last year, I think it was May, maybe. I went up to northeastern Oklahoma and went turkey hunting with a group called Hunt to Eat. You know, they invited me to come up and mentor some other hunters, and it was great. And so I met a young lady there that was good friends with the founders of Hunters of Color. And so we just somehow hit it off. And she was like, oh, you need to meet these folks. And so I met, and very, very quickly, I could tell that we had a lot in common in terms of, you know, passions and synergies and all of that. And so, you know, I said, hey, do you guys, you know, are you looking for somebody to be on your board? I asked them, and they said, oh, yes, we would love you. You know, so I immediately just kind of got right into it and started, you know, working here, you know, in the South around, you know, how to develop, you know, programs and things like that for Hunters of Color, but also some of the broader issues that, you know, the organization is sort of developing. And, you know, and that has been, it's been very fulfilling, you know, in terms of, you know, the sort of really broad, diverse organization that Hunters of Color is, and a lot of its partnerships with other organizations as well. Again, you know, you really see this wonderful renaissance taking place of young people who are sort of discovering what it means to be conservationists and to be hunters and outdoors people, and why all of that's important, and why it isn't, of course, about just quote unquote murdering something and all of that, and how hunting is literally at the very core of food culture and not necessarily that of gun culture, if you will, right? And so, you know, that whole experience, man, has been, it's been great. Just meeting people from all over the place. Many of them are much younger than I am, but sort of, you know, came to this in some way, you know, from either just a driven sense of this is something that I want to do, or stories that they heard from their own families, you know. And, you know, I think that, again, those things are they're the most powerful. When you have a story that you can connect to your legacy, and that word is, of course, very important for me, which is why I named my company Legacy. But when you have a story that you can connect to your legacy and you pass that story on, I don't think there's anything more important, if you will, in terms of your past and your future than when you can identify your experience right now with that of people before you and pass that along into the future to people that come after you. And I don't know anything, man, that sort of brings the circle of life home more than hunting. You know, I don't think there is anything. You know, growing up hunting in my dad's hunting club, you know, I really have always sort of had this impression that that the folks that were members of that had a totally different kind of understanding, if you will, on what, you know, what life and death was, and have sort of always seen that in a lens that was different. It was very complicated in a way, but it was also, you know, there was also a quietness to it all that was ever present. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I just hope I get to pursue it, you know, and you know, until I can't go any further, because, it has been, you know, just the stories alone. Like this past year, I was invited to go out to Nebraska and go mule deer hunting and out there. And my brother and I, we had not been in the woods. Our brother is 10 years older than me, and we had not been in the woods together in almost 15 years, just because of life, right? And so several things happened. For one, I remember growing up as a kid always sort of being in my brother's shadow, right? Sort of being in his silhouette when we were doing anything around the farm or we were walking or whatever. And I had not... You know, I had not been in his silhouette in that way in years until we were walking 3 miles in to set up a ground blind, you know, to, you know, and so there was this thing that took place then. And then, you know, on that trip, unfortunately, I got word that I lost my mother-in-law. And so we had to, you know, we had to cut short. And I know I'm kind of getting deep here, but this is what hunting is for me. You know, it's my story. You know, it's the angst of thinking about, you know, the call that I got. Hey, you know, things are not looking good. We need you to come home. And, you know, it's sort of that entire narrative. It's the wondering or the feeling of, I wish my dad could see my brother and I riding through Western Kansas and Nebraska. You know, I wish he could have saw that, you know, those two mule deer doe that just came, you know, I wish that he could have experienced. That is a part of my story, you know? And again, it's not something that I at all take lightly. I mean, that's what hunting has always been for me. You know, it's right. The constant day to day intertwined with my love of nature and my pursuit to go and get some food for the table that we're going to make and put our whole hearts into and sit around as a group and absolutely love each other together with it, you know? So, yeah,
That's good. You know, one thing I noticed we talked earlier, when I was in school around here, it was nothing to see African-American hunters. I mean, it was a common thing in the country.
Yeah.
When I came back, and now we all lived in the country. When I came back from college, most of those houses were gone, both white and black. Mm-hmm. You know, the farming had changed. People had moved to cities. And the next thing you know, you lose a generation, mm-hmm. and you never get them back mm-hmm. in the field. I mean, mm-hmm. we've seen that all over the map.
Yeah.
And knowing that it is a very difficult sport, not necessarily difficult, but it's an intimidating sport to try to mm-hmm. jump into on your own. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would love to do it. When you talk to them, they just don't know how, and right. they're intimidated by it. And hunters can be intimidating people.
Course.
I mean,
yeah.
when I go to Arkansas mm-hmm. duck hunting, to public areas, mm-hmm. as long as they don't see my plates, I'm fine. But when they see my license plate or the numbers on my boat, mm-hmm. I will have people mm-hmm. being
jerks,
pretty ugly.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just a small taste.
Yeah,
I think of probably what African Americans can mm-hmm. get mm-hmm. in the field.
Yes, of course. I think, you know, you just illustrated something that I think is so complicated, because sometimes, you know, being an African-American man, you know, if I encounter somebody who's being a jerk outdoors, my first thought is probably not that he's just naturally a jerk. My first thought is he probably has an issue with my race, right? And that is where our perceptions and our experiences, unfortunately, you know, if you will, they kind of get in the way of, you know, connecting with other humans. Now, you know, I've said this on a number of podcasts, and I feel passionate about it, but hunters, I think we have to be the ones to sort of regulate, you know, those jerks among us and make them feel not welcome. And, you know, and let them know that we're better than that. And we won't continue to accept that kind of thing. But, you know, hunting itself, man, I mean, you know, just think about it. You're outside and it's, you know, it's 25 degrees, it's 30 degrees. And, you know, if you're rabbit hunting, you're walking. If you're deer hunting, you're sitting still. You know, the human part of all that is what nature is doing to you at that moment. You're freezing or you're tired, right? Whatever it is. And yes, it can absolutely, you know, hunting itself can just take you apart. And that is, that's a part of it all, you know, is the discipline that it takes to learn to endure and withstand that experience and then excel, right? To continue to pursue that. And it's something that I feel really passionate about, where we always, Bill, we have to have conversations with people who look much different than us and think much differently than us. And we also have to be patient with each other in terms of, you know, those conversations that we have. And then we also have to have empathy with each other too, you know, whereas understanding that, first and foremost, we're all having a human experience, but we're also within that experience having complicated social things or whatever they are, you know, to inform that experience that could be negative for some or what have you. And so, you know, again, there's so many layers that you have to peel back in terms of identifying with folks and trying to understand, you know, where they come from. I've hunted a lot of different places. Most of the places I've ever been, I've been made to feel welcome, or, you know, I've just been kind of left alone. But I do, you know, I have been a few places where, you know, it was made pretty clear that I was not going to be made to feel welcome, unfortunately. And, you know, I for what it's worth, that, you know, I come from a pretty strong family background where, you know, I've received a lot of love. And so I know who I am. I don't really worry about that, you know? But I would also say, you know, I don't ever want to see anybody, literally no one, who is interested in hunting, be made to feel as if they are not welcome in nature. Nature is nature. It belongs to everybody, you know? And so that is kind of where I guess I get most fired up, you know, in terms of just making sure that everybody is at least allowed to experience and exist in nature and develop or what have you, you know, their own passions in the way that they prefer. So, you know.
Well, I got two things, because I want to follow this vein. But first, I was a little grumpy with you Southerners talking about 25, 30 degrees. It's really cold outside. Right, five below or something, and see how you do. But anyway.
Okay, go ahead.
But anyway, when you were talking about that, you know, on a more serious note, the how hunters and sportsmen and women have led on so many of these discussions, and when it comes to like wildlife conservation, right, have led and kind of broached some of those thresholds that haven't been there. And I think this, you know, these race relations, this, like, you know, the narrative that maybe African Americans haven't been involved in hunting and fishing as much as they should, we got to lead again, right? And and you're doing it. And I think the beauty of it is we have this tool, this vehicle, the outdoors, to take us there, right? Because we have an arena that's already so set for that, right? Which is so beautiful. And I love that. And, you know, I'm glad you're on the HOC board. You know, I've had Jimmy on this podcast before, and Marsha has had our Artemis podcast, had Lydia on.
Okay.
Lots of good folks there. I've had Crystal on this podcast, you know, so lots of good folks in those ranks. And so I'm glad you're there now too. You know, as we're getting closer to the end, Alex, I wanted to ask you too, what are you working on down, you know, conservation wise, any advocacy things, anything else you want to share us from your region that our listeners should know about?
You know, there are, I just say there's a number of things, and all of them are kind of loosely based around, you know, improving habitat and improving access, you know, for hunters to places that are really important that we manage. And, you know, a big part of, you know, what I mean when I say managing is ensuring that conservation dollars flow to these areas and ensuring that hunters and others are allowed the opportunity to experience those things, simply because, you know, we know how the North American wildlife model works, right? And how those, you know, conservation dollars that hunters contribute, you know, tend to improve these overall green spaces. And so that's a lot of the work that I'm doing, you know, just in ensuring that those things are always at the forefront of the conversations that we're having. You know,
we got to get you connected up with Vanishing Paradise, as we said. That's a good one you'd be perfect for.
Yes,
indeed. Yeah, we'll do some good stuff together.
Well, sounds
we'll
good.
Do some good
sounds
stuff.
Sounds good.
Well, good, Alex. Anything else you want to leave us with before we let you go back about your busy life?
Man, I can't think of a single thing right off the bat. I just want to say thank you guys for having me on your podcast, and you know, I really appreciate it. And, you know, I look forward to, you know, potential working together with you guys on different things in the future. So,
yes, sir. We appreciate it too. And, we're going to have to do that, that hunt trade one of these days. Bill Alex is bragging to me about, you know, whitetail, Mississippi Hill Country whitetail hunting. So I need to get in on that someday and get him out here for some elk or something.
That's right. There you go. Let's do it, man.
There you go.
Let's do it.
Y'all both come up here for some ducks.
Oh, don't. I'll do it now. I love duck hunting. If you invite me, I will show up, okay?
Next January, come on up.
I'll do it. I'll be there.
Yeah. Now, one thing we always do, we close the show out by everyone singing Rocky Top.
Oh, no, definitely not. No. No, man. Hell State here. I am not singing that awful song. No, thank you.
Well, we got the rivalry brewing right here on our podcast. Oh, I love it.
Awesome, man. This is great. Thank you guys both, man.
Well, thanks, Alex, so much for all you're doing. And we'll put links to your company and Hunters of Color and anything else you want us to put on in our show notes. And
absolutely.
We'll see you next time down the trail, my man.
Thank y'all so very much, man. Thank y'all.
For more great content, check out NWF Outdoors social media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Connect with us. We want to hear from you. Send us your ideas for podcast guests and questions in the comments.
We are NWF Outdoors.